Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Margaret Somerville, the founding director for the Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law at McGill University. She's going to talk to us about a recent Danish headline, plans to make Denmark a Down syndrome-free, perfect society. Welcome to the show.
Okay.
How did you come to get into this question of genetic differences and Denmark's attitude to them?
Well, my work is as an ethicist, as you probably know, and possibly some of your listeners know, and I've been doing that now since 1975, so it's a long time, and I was fortunate to be one of the early people in that field. It really started sort of in the early 1970s.
Okay.
And I did a doctoral degree here at McGill. I did it through the law faculty, but in fact it was what we would call today a bioethics or transdisciplinary doctorate. I did it in medicine, ethics, and law.
Okay.
And I did it on looking at how we regulated medical research that involved people as subjects. And of course, very often those people were vulnerable people, and very often they were treated in ways that today we regard with horror. That,
okay.
As you probably know, there's just been a disclosure in the United States about how the Americans did research on people in Guatemala who didn't know what was happening. And so I, as an ethicist, as a bioethicist, the most difficult and serious problems come up when people are not respected and when they're not protected, and particularly when they're vulnerable people. And so people with genetic aberrations are often one group of vulnerable people, and they're particularly vulnerable as an unborn child, because these days we've got all of these new tests that can be done very early, around 7 weeks of pregnancy, and women, a lot of women feel that there's, I don't know whether you'd say that there's nothing wrong. I think they do feel there's something wrong, but they're going to do it anyway, that they don't want to have that baby.
Right.
And one of those groups of babies are unborn babies with Down syndrome, and that can be tested for now probably around 7 weeks, and these women can decide they won't have them. And there was a headline about Denmark saying, well, this is wonderful that this is... This is actually, one bioethicist in Denmark described it as fantastic. And so I thought another bioethicist at least needed to weigh in and say, hey, wait a minute, this is not fantastic.
Yeah, your column quotes that Audrey Cole, the mother of a 47-year-old man with Down syndrome, writes, I have never been able to understand why my feelings as a parent of a wonderful, caring, gentle man can be so easily dismissed as special interest. Looks like the social benefits of having in society and raising a child that's genetically different are too easily disregarded.
Yes. Well, I mean, what we've come to see, I mean, or what some people have come to look at that as, is as a huge burden, a handicap, and it's not only being labeled as a handicap for the parents involved, but increasingly it's becoming labeled as a handicap and a disadvantage to society, and that's terribly dangerous. And, you know, we didn't have that issue before because we weren't able to test for these conditions, and you didn't know until your baby was born, you know, what features it had.
Yeah.
And so it's a big difference. I mean, the person that actually who's my hero in life and who I most admire in this regard is John Vanier.
Okay.
Who runs Lush, you know, the Ark. And that he founded that many, many decades ago, just outside Paris. And it's a permanent home for people with intellectual disabilities that they come there to live for the rest of their life. And Jean and the people who work with him have lived with them. And now there's, I think it's around 250 of these homes around the world.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, just recently I was asked to write a reference for him to nominate him for this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
Hmm.
And I think it would be absolutely wonderful if he won that.
Yeah, well, it certainly raised the profile of the issue and maybe regard for these people.
Yep. And you know, there's a saying in ethics that you can't test the what we call the ethical tone of a society by how it treats its strongest, most powerful, most admired people. You test it by how it treats its most vulnerable, weakest, and most in need citizens. And
yeah.
So I think we ought to keep that in mind as well. Certainly Jean does.
Yeah. Yeah. The use of science, you say, in search of human perfection has been at the root of some of the greatest atrocities.
Well, even the idea of human perfection, I mean, what would you say about somebody like Hitler? I mean, he was, so far as we know, I think, physically okay, but gosh, you know, something absolutely, totally, not just imperfect, but deeply evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think that's what Audrey Cole gets at, that she's a wonderful woman. She's been a huge activist for disabled people.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Where is she?
You know what, I email her all the time. I know at the moment she's on holiday in Nova Scotia.
Okay.
But I think she normally lives, I think it's in Ontario, but I'm not sure.
All right.
But she's an amazing woman. She's been a very strong spokesman for disabled people. And you know, she went on in that quote, which I put in the newspaper, that she said, "I'm frightened about the world that's coming." And I think that's true. I think that, you know, if we lose our sense of the worth of everybody and that everybody's got human dignity, it's got nothing to do with, you know, what you can do or who you are, we're in grave danger.
Yeah, Ontario passed a law in 2005 and brought it into effect in 2010. The other shoe drops for the effect of the law in 2012. In 2010, it applied to all government-linked organizations, and in 2012 it applies to all private organizations. I'm talking about the AODA. You're aware of it?
No.
There's not been a lot of publicity. It's the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, and it turns on supporting or denying dignity, is the word they use, and independence for disabled people.
Uh-huh.
And as an incentive to observe the law, which in the form of human rights law in Ontario has never carried substantial fines and as such has not engendered a lot of respect. The fines are enormous. I think it's meant to involve a resolution of the problems before it gets to that stage by setting the fines so high that they're unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
And people have to address the issue.
Yeah, but you see, that really does, I mean, that's great that it's going to help disabled people. But if people say, well, then we want to get rid of them because we don't want to have to do this, that's the issue that
I... So it could be a stigma.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. That's the problem.
Ontario's government has already been questioned about its treatment of disabled infants after they've been born. Slow coding in the hospitals, refusing surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, there's been Barbara Farlow has done a lot about because of her baby that had trisomy. I think it was 13, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
That's right.
And she sent an email to everybody. Over many years, she's spoken to me about that. And the other day I got an email saying that they've settled the case now, but they feel satisfied that the hospital that was involved has updated its guidelines and that what happened to their baby won't happen to babies in the future, that they will be treated without discrimination on the basis of their disability.
The settlement, does it involve any compensation?
I don't know.
Yeah, she's probably not allowed to say.
I don't know.
But she did use the term settled.
Yeah, she used the term, she said we've reached a settlement.
Very good.
We've signed a settlement, yeah. Yeah, I know. You know, it's really, isn't it? We've got to do something about our mindset.
Well, and the government, too. I mean, apparently these doctors feel, I don't know whether it's explicit from the government or whether it's implicit, that they've taken on, since the advent of Medicare, they seem to have taken on the role of public guardian of tax dollars, and they see disabled children as a threat to that guardianship.
Yeah, you know, I think, look, doctors are like everybody else.
Yeah.
Some of them, you know, we all have values.
Right.
And you've got to watch out when you're in healthcare that you don't develop what can be called moral callousness.
No.
That you see so many awful things and you see a lot of suffering, and you've also got to cope with that personally, and that, you know, you get this black humor, which is one way that some medical professionals do it, and also they can find it hard, especially when they're overburdened, to maintain their empathy and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people, some of the healthcare professionals, just like members of the general public, they really do put the value of people's lives on a spectrum from being worthless to being very valuable.
Yes, they do.
And I think that's what we've got to deal with, that that is not acceptable.
Yeah, I remember the case of the British man when the paramedics pulled up to his apartment, opened the door, found it too messy, and decided his life wasn't worth living, and then just didn't try to resuscitate him. Yeah, because of the shape his apartment was in.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't pass that test today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I just had exterminators in my apartment, and they were quite free with my things.
I caught two little mice in my apartment last night,
yeah.
And I don't believe in killing animals if we can possibly avoid it. So I caught them in, a live trap, and I took them down in the garden and put them out in the garden. They look very surprised.
I'll bet.
I think that's, we've got to make a lot of effort not to become morally callous.
Yeah.
Especially when we're in tough jobs where that's a way of protecting yourself.
How do you achieve that? I mean, especially when you're working 80 or 100 hours a week.
Yeah, well, you just, you know, you do your best to try, and you notice when you're not doing that. I think that's a very important thing to do. Not to get used to it.
You have to have some personal standards that trigger an alarm when you go over them.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I worry most about is the loss of respect for life.
And I mean,
that's why I'm so against euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide.
Right.
But of course, you can make a strong case by arguing that I'm being compassionate to this person, by arguing I'm respecting their autonomy and self-determination because they want it and they've given informed consent and that. But no matter how much of that you have, you're still ultimately not respecting life if you're taking it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's very different from allowing someone to die naturally.
Right.
I've got no objections when that's all ethically justified, that you would allow that to happen. But that's why, you know, I mean, I use very stark language. I say we can't have doctors killing people. And that's what we would do there, and we've got to realize what that means. And a lot of the other incidents we talk about with respect to, you know, respecting disabled people and respecting their life, all of that are sort of versions, they're lesser versions, but they're versions of the same thing, that we're not respecting the life of that person.
That's right. That's right, and we're not granting it the dignity of regarding it as human.
That's right. You know, it's, I sometimes vacillate between lots of hope, you know, that I hear these wonderful people. I see people like Jean Vanier. I see Audrey Cole and how she treats her son. And then I, you know, I hear these other things about, you know, well, they really gave this baby sort of an overdose of something because they didn't think its life was worth living.
Right.
And I vacillate between being in despair about that and being very hopeful that we will come through with the right values, because that's really what it's about. And it's not just values for us. It's the values that we want to pass on to future generations. And I've just been in Australia lecturing in 5 different cities. And over there, they've got the Greens in federal parliament with the balance of power.
Okay.
And the Greens are all very much pro-euthanasia, and they're pro-choice on abortion. And, you know, they're all what they label, in, I'd put in inverted commas, as progressive values. And what I was talking about was that the Greens have done a really good job, I think, in making us aware of how we can destroy our physical environment and how we've got obligations to hold our physical environment on trust for future generations. And what I think we have to do now, and I don't think the Greens are going to do it, but some of us have to do this, is also recognize that we've got what I call a metaphysical environment. That is an intangible environment that consists of our deepest and most important values, attitudes, beliefs, and so on. And that also can be destroyed, and we have to hold it on trust and pass it on to future generations.
I never thought of that. That's quite a vivid metaphor.
And now, Kenny Blues Boss Wayne, Searching for My Baby.
Circle round and round, up and down, here and there and everywhere, hoping to find what I call mine. Searching for my baby somewhere out there, searching for my baby somewhere out there, going from state to state, town to town, looking around, down the street, people I greet, hoping to find what I call mine. Searching for my baby somewhere out there, searching for my baby somewhere out there. I don't mean to take up your time, 'cause I know she's mine. Understand my point of view. If you see her, you'll love her too. Stop at the cafe, every juice joint, every viewpoint, at a county fair, land and air, hoping to find what I call mine. Searching for my baby somewhere out there, searching for my baby somewhere out there.
circle, round and round, up and down, here and there, and everywhere, hoping to find what I call mine, searching for my baby, somewhere out there, searching for my baby, somewhere out there, searching for my baby, somewhere out there, searching for my baby, somewhere out there.
You've been listening to Margaret Somerville, the founding director for the Center of Medicine, Ethics, and Law at McGill University, who talks to us about respect for human life despite disability and protection of the moral and ethical environment that has given us our lives today.
What do you think the role is for advocates in doing this, as opposed to bioethicists or in concert with bioethicists?
We've all got a role. These are not either ors, they're and.
Okay.
You've got to be careful. I'm not an advocate. A lot of people try to label me that. I never go before a committee or a court or a body or anything unless I'm actually invited to come.
Okay.
I never apply to appear.
All right.
And I do that because I don't want to be seen as an advocate. I want to be seen as somebody who, to the best of my humble ability, puts out the arguments and the ways of perceiving these situations in the most complete way that I can. And then it's for other people to decide what they want to follow among those alternatives.
Yeah.
But I think advocates have got a role, and if we do, and we need collective action. But again, I've never joined in a collective action. But I fully agree that, you know, other people must do so, because you need a strong voice.
Yeah.
And
does that mean a number of voices too?
Pardon?
A number of voices too?
Oh yes, you need. Yes, I mean that's the nature of a democracy. Nobody should be excluded.
All right. So in your eyes, there is a role for the rock the boat people,
yeah.
as well as the people with insights that enable society to look at their dilemmas in new ways.
Yeah. We need that. It's not an event. You don't reach a conclusion and then you can say, well, now I can relax forever. There's nothing more to do. This is a continually ongoing process.
Yeah, your column reveals that. I mean, the increasing inexpensiveness and accuracy of prenatal testing has changed the whole environment of moral decisions for disabled people.
But it's not just disabled people. I mean, it's people who say, well, I want a boy first and I want a girl second, so I'm going to get pregnant, then I'll get tested, and if it's not a boy, I'll get rid of it.
Right.
I mean, we've got 160 million missing girls in India and China.
Oh, no.
And you've got all sorts of, as a result of sex selection abortion.
Yeah.
And you've got all sorts of problems, societal problems, that, you know, young men can't find a wife, and so they get into gangs and crimes, and there's an increase in prostitution. I mean, we hear these terrible cases of a father with three sons buying a young woman from a neighboring foreign country and bringing her home, and the four men all use her sexually.
Oh, no.
I mean, terrible stuff.
Mm.
So that's the sort of things that we have to, you know, think about as well. At a very ordinary level as well. You know, it does seem that a lot of people think the ideal family is a boy first and a girl second.
Why?
Well, it just seems that's how they think. I mean, I guess it must be a hangover of men in the lead role or something.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, what's interesting about that, apart from the fact that I don't agree with sex selection, is that we know from studies that most very successful women are first-born women, first-born
children. Oh, really? Okay.
First-born children. And so we could upset the whole of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, even the feminists shouldn't go for that.
No. You made an interesting statement towards the end of it, too, that the well are the undiagnosed sick.
Yep.
Meaning that sickness is in all our futures?
Yes, of course it is.
Okay.
Unless we get killed by an accident when we're young.
Right.
But, you know, that's the natural life arc, isn't it? And what I mean by that is that if we did enough tests, even on a newborn baby, we could probably say, well, it's got this gene, and that means this and that and something else. And to some extent, you know, what we define as an illness is also culturally based.
Tell us about it.
Well, I don't know a lot about it. It's not my field, but, you know, I come across this sort of stuff about how, you know, some cultures handle people who are different, and they can revere them in certain ways.
Yeah.
Or give them special roles. One of my very close friends is a professor in religious studies.
Right.
And she looks at a lot of the ways that cultures handle those sorts of things. And they can be shamans, for example, and honored in the community, but yet they're very different from everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And I suppose if prenatal testing continues apace, we'll soon be able to identify the likelihood of someone developing an illness 50 or 60 or 70 years down the road, and will we come to regard that as an illness in itself?
Well, you know, many years ago when this sort of testing first started and it was very novel and everybody was astonished by it, I was in Boston at a meeting,
mm-hmm.
and there was a geneticist there. This is probably about 25 years at least ago. And he got up and he said, well, look, this is the sort of issue that we're going to have to deal with. He said, we will be making the embryos, that's new human life,
mm-hmm.
in a petri dish, you know, in vitro fertilization.
Right.
We will take, and they're doing this now, it's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where they take one cell from the embryo and they do a complete genetic screen on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and we'll have 5 embryos in that test, in that petri dish. And he'll say, well, Mrs. Smith, here's your 5 embryos. We think this one's going to have a heart attack around middle age.
Really?
We think this one's going to get cancer. We think this one's got a very clear genetic disease. Let's say it's cystic fibrosis or something like that. And then he said, and the last one, he said, we found abnormalities in its genome, but we don't know what those abnormalities mean at this time because we haven't got the means of deciphering them. Which one would you like to have as your baby?
Oh, no.
You see that? I mean, that's what ultimate choice is. You know, This is
for the future?
Pardon?
This is for the future?
Well, no, that can be done now.
Oh, I see.
I mean, a lot of it. It depends on how many tests we've got.
Right.
I mean, and some things you still can't test for, but we've got rapidly increasing number of tests. I mean, and rapidly increasing and earlier.
Yeah.
But this is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. That is where you haven't even put the embryos back into the woman's uterus. You've still got them in the petri dish.
Yeah, and you've got the ethical dilemma.
Taking a cell and testing it.
Yeah,
the other thing we don't know is what impact does taking that cell have on the in vitro fertilized embryo. The other thing we may not know everything about either is what's the impact of in vitro fertilization. There was a report this week that it might be associated in some way with autism.
Oh.
So, you know, these are the things we don't know. You know what?
We're playing with things we don't understand.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've got to be enormously humble in front of our new science. It gives us incredible knowledge. But there's a Japanese saying that says that as the radius of knowledge expands, the circumference of ignorance increases.
Yeah.
And what that means is I always imagine the knowledge is like a laser beam going out into the darkness of our unknowing. And the further out that goes, the bigger the circle that we're drawing and the more darkness we're opening up.
Mm-hmm.
We know that we know that we don't know.
Yeah.
And I think we should be very, very careful and humble in front of that.
Well, that's quite a lesson. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about regard for particularly disabled embryos and infants and people on our show before we close?
It's a very difficult thing to deal with. That, I mean, my basic rule is that we have to have respect for all life, and in particular human life. And I think that overall we will lose enormously by this current sort of drive to eliminate disabled people. But I don't think they should be respected only because we will lose if they're not. They should be respected because they're human beings, and every human life deserves the utmost respect.
I also think they bring different values into our lives.
They do.
Such as a sense of present time, a sense of play, a sense of what's immediately important and what's not.
And often a sense of humor, too. And a sense of love.
Bless them for that. And a sense of love, yes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's what where Jean Vanier is so absolutely, totally impressive, that he says that what we need is just a little bit of love in the world. And I think he's absolutely right. And I think that very often people with disabilities who struggle to cope with that can show us that. And we need to learn from it.
Yeah, we certainly do. Well, I appreciate very much your time on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Well, thanks, Margaret. Bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Margaret Somerville, the founding director for the Center of Medicine, Ethics, and Law at McGill University, who talks to us about respect for human life despite disability and protection of the moral and ethical environment that has given us our lives today. Now to take us into the news, Joe Louis Walker, Rollin' and a Tumblin'.
I've been rolling and I'm rolling. Rolling.
And now it's time for Disrespect's review of the news. At the end of the summer and the beginning of the fall, we have a review of the summer's news for you. Start off the news for the new year. August 30th, U.S. cotton farmers and ranchers battle Dust Bowl conditions. More than 50% of the area in a six-state region in the southern U.S., which consists of Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee, is experiencing exceptional drought, according to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's U.S. Drought Monitor. Oklahoma had the hottest July ever, according to the Oklahoma Climatological Survey. The one-year drought is the most severe on records, going back to 1895. It's by far the worst drought I've ever been through, said Dallin Hancock, 52, who has farmed cotton for three decades near Lubbock, Texas, and lost more than half of the 5,850 acres he planted this year. We thought we'd kind of seen it all to some degree. This rewrote the books. Cotton producers and users buffeted by wildly volatile cotton prices over the past 12 months are facing another shift. Cotton hit an all-time high in March as flooding in Pakistan and freezes in China ruined crops, but has since slumped 53%, more than any other commodity this year. Now the worst crop conditions since the 1930s are tightening domestic supplies and boosting prospects for a rebound. Cotton farmers aren't the only ones suffering. Withered fields mean hay prices are soaring, forcing many ranchers to make a difficult choice between paying high prices or culling their cattle. Ranchers in much of Texas, Oklahoma, and even Kansas are paying inflated prices for hay trucked hundreds of kilometers from Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, or South Dakota. The average price of hay climbed to $170 per ton this summer from $112 per ton last July, not including shipping costs. Texas AgriLife Extension Service drought specialist Travis Miller said many livestock auctions in the state are so busy right now they've been turning cattle away as ranchers sell off livestock at double or triple the normal rate. Insurance claims will be higher than in recent years because of damage to non-irrigated dryland cotton and crops, according to Ted Etheridge. He's the president of Lubbock, Texas-based ArmTech Insurance, the fifth largest U.S. writer of federally sponsored crop policies. Meanwhile, those who are able to harvest their crops will earn more. U.S. farmers overall are expected to make record profits this year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates. And that in the Globe and Mail, source, News Services. Wednesday, August 10th, The Unentitled Riot at the Loss of Their Future, by Mel Capp, former High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. Imagine you're a parent in London trying to persuade your teenagers to stay home at night and not go out looting. These are poor, unemployed, uneducated kids without a future rioting in London. Imagine your kids texting their friends trying to decide where to meet and what stores to hit. This is not rioting to make a political point. Imagine adults making up shopping lists, deciding what color trainers to steal. This is only partly about spontaneous anarchy. Imagine being a Canadian tourist and being afraid to go to the Whitechapel Gallery. This is the height of the tourist season in London. Remember, even William the Conqueror did not loot London. This is not about a lot of things. It's not about the Great Recession of 2008, and it definitely is not about this month's decline in equity and bond markets. These people did not have their savings wiped out. They already had none. It's not just about the police shooting of a young black boy, although that's a trigger. It's not just about London. If it had happened in Bradford and Leeds, I would have understood. But it's not just about the racial divides in the Midlands, and it's not just about the decline of the industrial heartland in the Midlands. It's not poor people going to Mayfair and Kensington to riot and loot the wealthy and upper class. These are people destroying their own neighborhoods and making it harder for merchants to serve them at home. It's not just about yobs and criminals. These are also moms taking the time to try on sneakers in the store before taking them. And this is not about the Olympics destroying their neighborhoods. Rather, the coming Olympics have rejuvenated East London with projects on time and under budget.
How will the world feel, though, about going to London in 10 months for the Games? Too bad the tickets are not all sold. There is no point to London in 2011. The current unrest in Madrid, Athens, Rome, and Tel Aviv has political objectives. The Continental Riders have purpose and discipline. London's have none. The Cameron Clegg government has to bring order first, but then try to respond to the underlying malaise that economic decline, profound structural adjustment, and an immigration policy with haphazard integration have caused. It turns out that the veneer of society is so very, very thin. Give them hope for a future, and you might be able to put the genie back in the bottle. August 10th, Globe and Mail. Board nixes promotions for G20 cops. The Toronto Police Board's taken the unprecedented step of refusing to promote 9 officers who were disciplined for removing their name tags during G20 demonstrations. Chief Bill Blair recommended those promotions, and the Civilian Oversight Board's refusal to agree suggests cracks in what has historically been a close relationship. On Tuesday, the Police Association filed a grievance. If the arbitrator sides with the police board, it will make clear a currently gray area regarding the board's powers to refuse promotions. In the past, the board has passively pushed through reclassification recommendations from the chief, including for officers who have unbecoming conduct on their records. That practice has become a sore spot for years among some on the board who feel uneasy about giving more authority to officers they believe have shown questionable judgment and character. Tensions on the police board first surfaced after Mayor Rob Ford appointed Councillor Michael Thompson as its vice chair. Thompson and Blair have quietly clashed on a number of issues. Most recently, Thompson said he was extremely disappointed that Blair spoke out about potential layoffs. That from Torstar News Service in the Metro News, the weekend edition, September 2nd to 5th. And could a better support system have saved 21-year-old. Iki Tervelt was jolted awake around 1 a.m. July 22nd by the sound of a child howling. The little guy, he was screaming. I thought, what are they doing to that kid? The panicked wailing lasted 15 minutes. The 90-year-old poked her head out her apartment door but saw nothing in the hallway. It wasn't until late that afternoon that someone called the police after Ms. Shadidi's father, Abdul Ghafoor, went racing through the hall sobbing. He was crying and screaming. He said, call 911. My daughter killed herself. Ms. Terveld's son, Jake, who lives in the apartment beside hers, went in and saw the still body on the bed. No blood, but marks of strangulation, and the toddler there with her, as he had been for more than 15 hours. Ms. Shadidi married Mr. Rustam at her parents' request when she was 18 and he 24. She'd spent the past several years studying in Karachi, Pakistan. When she got pregnant, she came back to Canada after tests revealed multiple complications. Tala was born in Toronto in 2009. An operation at SickKids Hospital this year gave him a new heart. Ms. Shadidi spent much of her time trying to get Mr. Rustam to Canada. He arrived in May. She met him at Pearson Airport. Her friends don't know or won't say what happened from there. What drives Kripa Sikar mad? The support network her organization has been painstakingly building for the 3 decades past was cut off at the knees this year. The South Asian Women's Center, of which Mrs. Sikar is their executive director, lost more than $500,000 in federal funding as of April 1st. Included in the space and salaries they lost were multilingual counselors at a community center just blocks from the apartment where Mrs. Shadidi died. Those trained staff knew how important it would be to find her a place where she'd be safe. That was a solid knowledge base that's been lost, just cut at the root, Ms. Sikar said. When you eliminate resources like this, there will be no way to provide any substantive service to women. That from the Globe and Mail, Anna Mailer Paperny. Baffled friends and family mourn gentle, silent giant.
6 foot, 250-pound Charlie couldn't respond when police tried to arrest him. And McGillivray's son, Charles McGillivray, collapsed and died while being arrested by police at the corner of Christie and Bloor Streets on Monday night because of a childhood accident. He couldn't speak. The 6-foot-tall McGillivray loved barbecued-flavored chips and ice cream even during the winter. He was a little boy living inside the body of a burly 46-year-old man. He communicated with his mother using sign language and a handful of words only she could understand. Police tackled and arrested him, according to eyewitness accounts, but it's still not clear why. The SIU, still investigating, said in a release that officers were investigating in the neighborhood before Mr. McGillivray's arrest. The release said McGillivray collapsed after a physical interaction during the arrest. On the Monday, Ann didn't see the police initiate the arrest. "I asked the police, 'Why is Charlie on the ground?' Ann said. 'I told them he can't answer you. He's mentally retarded. He can't speak. He can't answer you. He uses signs.' The police told her to shut up and back away," Ann said. Then she saw McGillivray's face turn blue. She believes he went into cardiac arrest. He was taken to Toronto Western Hospital, where he died. "If you don't know him, he looked like a scary guy because he was so big," said Adie, a neighbor who often helps out the family. "But he loved his mom so much, he always wanted to be with her. He wouldn't harm a fly." Allison Cross in the Toronto Star. And in a landmark referendum, BC voted widely to kill the despised HST. BC Finance Minister Kevin Falcon said BC will return to a PST-GST split within 18 months, and he'll meet with Federal Finance Minister Jim Flaherty next month to discuss repayment of the $1.6 billion in transitional funding Ottawa paid BC to adopt the tax. He also said BC will tighten operational spending but not job-creating capital expenditures and balance its books as scheduled by 2013-2014. In July 2009, 2 months after a provincial election in which the BC Liberals ruled out the HST, Mr. Campbell announced the province would follow Ontario's lead in creating a single harmonized sales tax. Mr. Campbell resigned in late 2010, only 17 months into a third Liberal term, suggesting his own unpopularity over the HST was blocking the government's economic agenda. "I think for many people it was really difficult to get over the way this tax was brought in, and I think you saw that in the result," said new Premier Christy Clark, promising better engagement with citizens. That in the Globe and Mail by Ian Bailey in Vancouver and Brennan Clark in Victoria, with reports from Sonny Dillon in Vancouver and Karen Hallett in Toronto. Samsung energy deal seen costing consumers. Analyst says bills could rise $786 million a year. Ontario's consumers risk paying up to $65 a year extra in electricity bills because of the province's renewable energy agreement with Samsung C&T Corp, says an energy analyst. Igent Energy Advisors calculates that consumers will collectively pay up to $786 million more annually for power generated by the 2,000 megawatts of wind power and 500 megawatts of solar power that Samsung will install. Igent says the added cost will come largely because Samsung's output will command a premium price, averaging 17 cents per kilowatt hour in the first year and rising to 18.2 cents per kilowatt hour by the end of the 20-year agreement. That compares with a current average price in Ontario, including power sold both under contract and on the open market, of 7 cents per kilowatt hour. Moreover, Igent says Ontario already has enough electricity. As a result, much of the power produced by Samsung will be exported at prices of 3 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour. If 100% of Samsung's output is exported, Ontario would lose $786 million under current market conditions, Igent estimates. And that's $65 per household. If your mom knew Dalton McGuinty had cut your special diet allowance and cut the size and nutritional content of your meals, she'd be up one side of him and down the other, wouldn't she? But we have something for you to do when your meal finishes too soon
because your special diet allowance has been reduced. We call it things to do when the special diet short-circuits your dinner. Tonight we introduce Alphagetti grocery lists. Now we know that when you went to the grocery store, that is, when you could afford to go to the grocery store, that you made a grocery list so you could spend and receive what you'd planned. But now you have to make a grocery list for when you go to the food bank. And while there's no guarantee they'll have what's on your list, hey, it can be fun. First, you need a can of Alphagetti, which with luck you've been waiting to eat since you got it a few months ago from the food bank. Then you need a plate. Pour the Alphagetti on the plate and look at all those letters. Now spell out what you need. If it takes half an hour, that's okay. If it takes an hour, if it takes 2 hours, that's good. It gives you time for your dinner that the special diet won't give. When you've finished your list, freeze it. Maybe on a piece of wax paper. Hey, maybe on a cardboard pizza liner that your neighbors left behind. I know you can't afford pizza anymore, but hey, maybe your neighbors can, and you're not going to eat it anyway. And take it down to the food bank, and when they ask what you want, show them your frozen Alphagetti grocery list. Something else to do when your special diet has cut short your meal and your meal time. Come back next week for more fun things to do now that your special diet has been cut. Oh, and don't let me forget to mention the disrespect petition against tracking your whereabouts on the new Presto card in Hamilton and in Toronto. It's at gopetition.com or Canadian Petition Online. Sign up and show your protest as we approach the provincial election October 6th. Tell Dalton McGuinty or whoever wins the election you don't want them keeping track of your whereabouts through a transit fare card. Now, Joe Louis Walker to take us out. Midnight Train.
Well, that midnight train took my baby away. I get
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.